Welcome to the RotoWire Prospect Podcast. I'm Clay Link alongside James Anderson. You can find James on Twitter at RealJRAnderson. I'm at Clay W. Link. Sixth episode of the RotoWire Prospect Podcast already. Going to be looking at James's tiered prospect rankings for 2015. Made it through only a couple tiers last time, so going to finish that off today. You know, once the regular season starts, though, we're going to be watching one minor league game per week, bringing you our firsthand takes and analysis on those, looking primarily at key matchups, maybe a prime pitching matchup or a stacked lineup taking on a high name pitcher, big name pitcher. But for right now, we're just sticking to the article, and also going to be grading out one of the former WWE tag team that I think people kind of sleep on maybe a little bit.
Yeah, I'm not sleeping on them.
Well, maybe people just forget about them.
Yeah, I mean they're a very, very unique look. It's going to be a very unique end of the show segment. We've been grading out some pretty big name, some high quality wrestlers, and this week we're kind of grading out a couple guys who, even if you added up their total grades, might not even out with some of those other guys.
Yeah, I guess sleeping on them was the wrong choice of words. I mean,
they'll sleep on you.
This is a team that, I mean, I think people may remember, but I mean, we'll get to it later. But I think, definitely a staple of the late 80s, early 90s WWF, as it was at the time. But before we get into your tiered prospect rankings, James, just want to touch on big prospect news of the day. That's Hector Olivera signing a $62.5 million contract with the Dodgers. Now, their infield is already pretty full, with Juan Uribe, Howie Kendrick. Those guys put Alex Guerrero on the outside looking in. So Olivera, definitely not a clear path to playing time. And, of course, there's concerns about the UCL as well. If I just had to ask you, of course, I don't mean to put you on the spot, but if you had to slot Olivera into your prospect rankings right now, James, where do you think you'd throw him?
On the latest iteration I have, I would probably slot him in maybe in the kind of 24 to 26 range, maybe in between Kyle Schwarber and Steven Souza, who I kind of have in there right now. I mean, he's not really in that Yoan Moncada class of a guy who I could really see, being a franchise linchpin for the next decade or so. I mean, all those guys that are kind of up in that top 10 range are guys that you can just build around for the foreseeable future. I mean, at 30 years old, he would be by far the oldest guy in the top 200 prospect rankings. I mean, he really shouldn't even, I mean, he's a prospect because he hasn't met the qualifications you would need to not be rookie eligible, but I mean, he's a veteran in all sense and purposes. So yeah, I mean, it's, the upside is he's basically in his prime right now. So, I mean, his best years are going to be kind of this year and the following year. I mean, it's basically everything we said about Alex Guerrero that makes it tough to kind of figure out what to do with him. It's just kind of amplified with Olivera, and it makes Alex Guerrero now seem even less likely to ever figure in things there.
That's true. I mean, Guerrero, some encouraging reports out of camp that he was, getting acclimated to third, showing some comfort at that position. But now, I mean, Juan Uribe and Kendrick are both free agents after this year, though. So that's something to keep in mind. But yeah, for this year, I think Olivera's, not going to really be a factor. But we just submitted our individual top 200s, myself, you, and Derek Van Riper, for a RotoWire Roundtable Prospect Rankings. We haven't actually done that for the site, so I'm pretty excited about that. But since we did just submit those and the article isn't up yet, going to focus on that next week and hit the tiered rankings. But, yeah, I really haven't thought of – I mean, I thought about it a little bit last night when I was, putting my final touches on it, but I really don't know where I'd put Olivera, but I think that's a fair range.
The thing is, I don't think you can just – I mean, they're just kind of stockpiling pieces. Mm-hmm. And at his age, obviously the health is the first thing that you're going to have to kind of figure out with him, because if he does need some sort of a surgery or maybe his arm just can't handle the throws from third right now, and you can't move Howie Kendrick off a second, really. So there's no obvious place, but it's also wouldn't make much sense to me to keep him in the minors for a year. So it's kind of like, you know, there should be another shoe to drop or something here, it would seem, but maybe they're just kind of loading up on depth.
Yeah, and again, I think with that, you know, the guy's set to hit free agency next year. I think it's a smart move, but owners need to be aware that, you know, neither has a clear path to playing time this year, Alex Guerra or Oliveira. But we're going to hit these prospect rankings, the tiered rankings. Again, last week we did the hitters for shallower leagues and the starting pitchers for mixed leagues. So be sure to go back and check that out if you want to hear our thoughts on some of those bigger names. But we'll start here with hitters to stash in deeper leagues. I'm going to run them down in reverse order. Giovanni Urshela, Stephen Piscotty, Francisco Lindor, Alex Guerrero, who we just talked about, Jake Lamb, Jung-Ho Kang, Michael Franco, Michael Taylor of the Nationals, Micah Johnson, and Jose Peraza. Now, these are all names that, you know, I think a lot of people have in the back of their mind as end-game targets. Peraza's your favorite there, though. You know, with the emergence of Jace Peterson, does that make you nervous at all that, you know, he could be delayed further than expected?
I was never really expecting Peraza to come up before June or July. So in that sense, not really. I mean, Jace Peterson, the quote-unquote emergence of Jace Peterson, that's not going to look like an emergence come May or June. So I'm not too worried about that, no.
You know, I found a spot for Peterson on my prospect list just because, I mean, he does have speed. I think he has three seasons in the minors with 39 or more stolen bases. He's looked pretty good this spring. And, you know, manager Freddie Gonzalez, you know, has said that he has the leg up. I mean, they signed Alberto Cayasso in the offseason, but he showed up to camp a little out of shape, to say the least, and hasn't fared well at all this spring. So just the fact that he has a path to playing time made him a fit on my list. But I understand, you know, last year with the Padres at the major league level, he was pretty abysmal. But you're confident that Peraza will have no problems, you know, overtaking him by midseason latest?
I don't think that he will be held down for reasons that have anything to do with what's happening on the big league club. I think that he'll be held down. If he is held down, it's going to be, you know, about his future contract situation, or it's going to be because for whatever reason he's struggling in ways that we didn't foresee.
Yeah, struggled with the major league team this spring. You know, looked overmatched, so the team sent him down to minor league camp. Probably good. Just get him more at bats. Let him, you know, work out those kinks for now. But jumping to the other end of the spectrum, you know, Peraza's your top hitter to stash in deeper leagues. But Giovanni Urshela, now Lonnie Chisenhall, hot first half last year for the Indians at the hot corner, but really kind of fell apart down the stretch. Urshela, you know, very good defensively, did take a step forward at the plate last year, but do you think he'll be able to produce at the major league level that is actually useful for fantasy owners this year?
You know, he's not someone that you – I mean, yeah, this is hitters to stash in deeper leagues. He's the last guy on the list. So, I mean, we're talking AL onlys, that kind of thing with Urshela. And in any real mixed league that doesn't have a bunch of minor league spots, you're just kind of watch-listing him. And the plan with him is for Chisenhall to not be great, which I don't expect him to be, and then – Urshela to kind of hit out of the gate and mash his way to the big leagues, because the Indians have World Series aspirations. I don't really see Chisenhall being a big part of that from a positive standpoint. So I could see them kind of having a need there that he would be able to fill come June or July.
Yeah, I saw the Indians on the cover of, I think it was Sports Illustrated. High hopes there in Cleveland for sure. I'm kind of bummed that my guy TJ House has been getting knocked around quite a bit lately. Zach McAllister actually looks really good. I watched some of his outing against the A's yesterday, and he was finally able to locate the fastball a little bit and get some swings and misses, but I still think he's, you know, I still think it should be House, and I think it will be House in the rotation, but still a lot to figure out there. Now, you have Lindor, you know, a top prospect, but is his position on this list, you know, third from the bottom, at least for hitters to stash in deeper leagues? Is that more about, you know, his expected ETA for you?
Yeah, well, he's going to have an issue where Jose Ramirez and Jason Kipnis, you know, one of those two is going to have to either be struggling or hurt, I think, for Lindor to come up and just take all the at-bats, you know, in June or July or something like that. And I don't think either one of those guys is going to be struggling to the point where they're going to lose out on playing time. Like, I like Jose Ramirez a decent amount, and, you know, I think that when Lindor does come up, it might not be till, you know, late July or August or something like that, because they're not going to bring him up just to have him play every third or fourth day. I think that they're going to, you know, want to find a way to maximize his at-bats this year, whether it be at Triple-A or in the majors. I mean, he's a definite building block for them, but, I mean, you can't have too much depth. I mean, mm-hmm. There's going to be an injury or something, but, I mean, it's kind of murky right now as to where he slots in.
Still just 21 years old, right. Yeah. I mean, doesn't turn 22 until November, so.
And he could be one of those guys that, like, struggles out of the gate against big league pitching. Like, I like him long-term a lot, and he was actually a guy in our prospect roundtable ranks. You, DVR, and myself all had him ranked exactly 16th overall. So,
oh, wow.
I mean, the big consensus that he's a top 20 guy in that respect, but, you know, with his age, like you alluded to, I mean, he could definitely struggle out of the gate.
Yeah, I mean, numbers last year, though, as a 21-year-old between AA and high A, or AA and AAA, certainly impressive. I mean, 11 combined homers, 28 steals, was caught on the base pass 16 times, but, you know, 49 walks against just 97 strikeouts and 567 plate appearances. That's pretty good recognition, plate discipline for a kid that age, definitely. And I think, you know, he's heralded in large part due to his defense, but definitely going to develop into a solid offensive contributor. We're all confident of that. Now, the next guy on your list here, we'll jump up. We talked about Guerrero a bit, but Jake Lamb now with the reports out of Diamondbacks camp that, you know, Yasmani Tomas, I mean, it's just uncertain where he's going to fit. I mean, I know he hit a homer yesterday. He's back to using the leg kick that he used in Cuba for a while. But do you think that, you know, with his spot on this list, that are you banking on Tomas moving to the outfield and Lamb having at least somewhat regular playing time? And if so, is that going to be available to him early on?
You know, I think it might, and I could see Tomas spending a good chunk of the year in the minor leagues. Oh. I mean, he's younger than, like, Rusne Castillo or Hector Olivera, like mm-hmm. we mentioned. I mean, if we're talking about Olivera getting sent down, then, you know, Yasmani Tomas
Castillo
could
too.
Definitely get sent down. Yeah, yeah, I mean, Castillo, yeah. I mean, Tomas is probably the one that needs the most refinement of those guys, and I was talking with DVR off air the other day, but you know, I heard Dave Cameron of Fangraphs, who's seen Tomas live, say that he just looks like another Dion Viciado, basically. So I mean, like, that's a realistic outcome here, is that
Yikes.
He just doesn't hit enough to be an everyday player. Mm-hmm. So I have my reservations about Jake Lamb as well. I don't necessarily think he's got the bat to be an everyday third baseman or a first division one, at least. But I mean, he's got the power to hit 20 homers over a full season.
Well, yeah, that's pretty troubling about Tomas. And this was before he homered yesterday, but I saw on Twitter just somebody saying, like, I just don't see where he fits on a major league roster right now, Tomas. And I mean, yeah, it's probably good that he's using the leg kick, but we speculated on it in recent months, just that we wouldn't be surprised if the Diamondbacks were the team to miss on that guy.
Yeah, and I want to know who had the second highest bid on him and what it was. I just think that it'd be hilarious
it'd be
if,
so
like,
cool.
The next highest bid was, like, 18 mil or something like that, you know?
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, that's not a guy. Tomas, I've been just moving down everything, prospect ranks, big board for this year. I don't. Someone in our stake league auction is going to bid like $20 on him, and I'm going to laugh pretty hard.
The power is definitely there, but he's looked like he kind of took the, you know, LeVon Hernandez route and just ate McDonald's.
Yeah, no, what all that weight that Jesus Montero lost, I feel like Yasmani Tomas somehow got it all.
I mean, that's the thing. It's with the success of Cuban players recently, is easy to see this guy as, you know, the big, you know, potential breakout option. And he's showing good opposite field power, but the fact that everything's going to the opposite field makes me think that, you know, he's kind of behind all these fastballs.
We maybe should have saved the Tomas discussion till the end, so we could have used it as a nice little segue into the wrestling segment there. Yeah. Just given the body type.
You know, I had a hard time with Tomas. Oh, that was good. With Tomas on the prospect rankings, because I was the high man on him in the updated round table, which I regret. I'm actually really pissed at myself for that. But I had to, you know, I couldn't bump him down too far in the prospect rankings just in light of that. But, you know, I did downgrade him significantly, you know, below, you know, 150. That was a no-brainer for me.
Were you asked to kind of, like,
no, thankfully. Okay. I just noticed that, though, because I was like, you know, I was thinking, you know, I was having trouble. I actually had Tomas pretty far down, but then I was like, well, I have him as a, you know, top 160 type of guy. I should bump him up a little bit, regretting doing that. But, you know, we'll see. Definitely going to be backing off and letting other people overpay significantly. But now we'll jump ahead a little bit here to Michael Taylor, who's looked good this spring. And, of course, with Denard Span out to begin the year, looks like he's going to have a path to playing time. Is he maybe somebody you'd even consider in, you know, shallower mixed leagues?
Yeah, he's really interesting because, you know, there's a good chunk of outfielders like your Hunter Pences and Denard Span, who he's going to be replacing in Washington, who you know that they're going to miss about a month. And Michael Taylor, you know, is going to, as long as he doesn't just fall flat on his face, he's going to be playing basically every day for about a month. And in that month, he could go, you know, five homers, five steals. I mean, the batting average might not be great, but you're just getting a month out of him, so it's not going to kill you. I think in maybe not like 10-team or 12-team mixers, but 14 teams and deeper, especially when you have a DL spot and you draft a guy like Hunter Pence and you throw him on there, you go pick up Michael Taylor and have him as your fill-in. I think that's a pretty strong play.
12 spring games with the big club entering today. Taylor, 12 for 37 with two doubles, two triples, three homers, five RBI, a steal, one walk, and 11 strikeouts. Not ideal. And, of course, you know, I'm with you. The average may hurt a bit, but the power-speed combination is enough to make me definitely intrigued. Now, this is a very deep league, but I traded for Taylor recently in Staff Keeper League 1. Got him and TJ House and a draft pick for Ryu, which is looking good now, just in the light that Ryu's injured and not really certain when he's going to come back. But definitely glad to have at least one share now, and hopefully we'll be able to pick up another shortly. Now, Micah Johnson, next on your list. Final one we'll touch on in this tier, but Micah Johnson, another guy having a really hot spring, batting .455 coming into today. Just two steals, caught once, but also has a homer, a double, and a triple. With this ranking on here, I guess I'm taking it that you're penciling him in as the White Sox second baseman to begin the year.
You know, kind of. For fantasy purposes, he's the only guy to pay attention to in that with that job. So it's not necessarily that I think that there's, you know, he's definitely going to get it, but if he gets it, then he becomes a guy that should be drafted in almost all formats. So this is kind of hedging by putting him in this category. I ended up being kind of aggressive with my rankings on him for the top, the most recent iteration of the top 200, because, you know, it's not a guy who in 3 or 4 years I would take over some guys like Nick Gordon or you know, guys lower down like that. But just over the next year or the next 2 years, there's a chance that he could have, you know, a poor man's D. Gordon type of season and could help you, you know, win a league title. So definitely someone that needs to be paid attention to, especially if you're kind of hurting in that middle infield spot.
Yeah, I mean, the guy I'd love to get for $2 or $3 at the end of Stake League auction, which we were talking about before coming on. Definitely need to be an eater this year, and hopefully Micah Johnson can push me up into that range. But I'll hit up your next tier, your high upside starters for watch lists. Part one, you broke this into two tiers, which was helpful. But this tier had 7 players going in reverse order here. Alex Chichi, Gonzalez, who I know you're a fan of, John Gray, Matt Whistler, Henry Owens, Dylan Bundy, Archie Bradley, and Steven Matz, number one on this tier. Henry Owens got knocked around a bit today, but do you think he can be up to contribute this year?
Yeah, I think that's probably the plan. They're not going to force it with him, but you know, they didn't have an issue giving a bunch of young arms some looks down the stretch last year. They don't have the pitching depth or quality on hand right now to say that, you know, he wouldn't be worth a shot if he's tearing it up in the upper levels of the minors this year. Not a huge, you know, I don't see number one potential. I don't even really see legit number two potential, but I think he's a fairly safe bet to be a solid number three, you know, big lefty. Yeah, I like him quite a bit. I like the team. I mean, it's a good opportunity for wins. I like some of this is such an interesting tier because all the guys are kind of different. Like, you know, Matt Whistler and Steven Matz, they're just blocked, you know, internally. I mean, they're probably, you know, two of the most big league ready guys on this tier, but they don't have, you know, anywhere to slot into their team's rotations. John Gray, I mean, John Gray and Archie Bradley both kind of do slot into their team's rotations if their teams were trying to compete this year, but they're not really. And they both have their own concerns too. Like Archie Bradley has the, you know, the control concerns from last year. I mean, I think he looked better in the fall league and everything like that, but it doesn't seem like the Diamondbacks are going to be pushing him too hard this year, given where they are on the win curve. And John Gray, obviously the Coors field factor, and you know, they don't want to bring him up and just have him get lit up in five outings and really kind of shake his confidence up. So, I mean, there's just a lot of different kind of profiles among this tier.
Yeah, definitely interesting tier, and hard to really know this year who's going to emerge. I mean, I know Bundy, they're setting a cap around 100 innings this year. So for fantasy purposes, I mean, those 100 innings could still be highly useful if you, you know, use them in the right situations. But
I think that they're going to be pretty creative, I would imagine, with just how they use him this year, because, you know, there's another team with, you know, they would like to go to the World Series this year, and it doesn't seem to me like it would be a good use of their resources to have Bundy just blow through those 100 innings and, you know, a bunch of starts in the first half in the minor leagues. I feel like he could be a guy that if he was given, say, a role like Dellin Betances last year or something like that in the second half for them, that could actually be useful even as a reliever in some deeper mixers.
Yeah, that'd be definitely a route to fantasy relevance this year for sure. Yeah, if they were able to use him in kind of a long role, maybe even to, you know, close some games out.
Yeah, or like, you know, what they were kind of doing with Kevin Gausman in recent years, where they did sort of a every other turn through the rotation, they would turn it into a 6-man rotation and just throw Bundy in for, you know, start here and there, and then he becomes a pretty interesting spot start option.
Definitely.
Alex Gonzalez is a guy that he just got sent down or sent to minor league camp today. I mean, he was kind of a long shot to make that rotation. He kind of had to be just unstoppable, I think, to kind of win the job outright, but he's going to start the year in AAA, and I really don't see – if you look at his minor league numbers, like, he's never really faced a challenge in the minor leagues. I mean, the numbers aren't overpowering. Like, he's not going to be a guy that's getting a K per nine or anything like that, but he could just be a really, really solid contributor in ERA and WHIP, and given there – I mean, that rotation's as decimated as any, so I think that you'll see Gonzalez up – you know, if I had to make a bet of which guy in this tier debuts in their rotation soonest, I think Gonzalez might actually be the call, although the upside with the strikeouts isn't quite where some of these other guys are at.
Yeah, I mean, Gonzalez was, you know, making them think twice for a little bit. I mean, really performing well in spring training. I'm going to have to go to somebody at the site because it's not your fault either, but it links to 38-year-old free agent shortstop Alex Gonzalez. Let's just change his name to Chi-Chi in the database.
That's been a very, very common issue with this with the prospect list I've been doing this year. There's been a lot of linking to like old veteran guys with some of these players, because I think it's a default system, you know, where it just kind of takes, oh, well, this guy, will obviously they're talking about the 38-year-old. Why would they be talking about the hot young pitching prospect?
Yeah, I just would like to maybe just add Chi-Chi into the database somehow. And
I'm definitely with you. I mean, it should just be Chi-Chi. I mean, yeah, I think on on certain websites, if you can't find him without searching Chi-Chi. So
yeah, that's, and I appreciate you wrote his outlook for this year, and I know you had Chi-Chi in there, but somehow through the editing process, I mean, maybe apparently somebody felt that was, you know, not needed and got rid of it. But you know, when you're talking about this guy, you have to know that you're talking about Chi-Chi. There's a lot of Alex Gonzalez.
It's a big, you know, it makes you sort of feel like a little closer connection to him.
Yeah. I definitely love that nickname. But, you know, just touching on Henry Owens real quick before we move on. Again, roughed up today, and I like him a decent amount. Traded for him in Staff Keeper League 2 recently. I'm fine with that. But, you know, there is one guy who, you know, maybe kind of slept on a little bit in that system, and that's Brian Johnson. I mean, he is 24, and he was only at the AA level last year, but really impressive numbers. I think he could be a guy who steps in and helps them out this year as well. Just a name to keep in mind.
They have a lot of guys that are just sort of kind of borderline. Like, are they good enough to be starters long-term for a team like the Red Sox? And, I mean, that seems kind of counterintuitive considering what their current rotation is made up of. I mean, it's like, well, this team clearly doesn't care about high-end pitching talent when they're going into a season with Rick Porcello as Porcello basically is their number one. But I mean, Johnson, you know, I think Stephen Wright was the guy that they were talking about as, like, if Joe Kelly has to miss a start, Stephen Wright's the guy that we think is most ready. And then you got Matt Barnes. I mean, there's a lot of guys that are just sort of, is he a four, is he a five, is he even a five? So I mean, Johnson, yeah, I mean, he might get a start this year, might get a few starts, but Owens is the one I think can make the biggest difference, like, impact-wise for fantasy owners.
I agree. I think Owens is the guy to own, but no denying just how successful Johnson was. As a 23-year-old last year at AA Portland, 10-2 with a 1.75 ERA, 0.93 whip, over 20 starts, 118 innings. Fared well in four relief appearances this spring, 2.35 ERA. It looks like he did crack the Baseball America top 100, but
how many? What was his K rate?
7.6 at AA, but combined between high A and AA, 8.3. So, you know, decent numbers. Walk rate was improved last year too, quite a bit. Had a 4.1 walk per nine mark at high A last year, or in 2013, but trimmed that all the way down to 2.5 at high A and 2.4 at AA. So good to see him take that step forward. And just a name to keep in mind. I mean, I agree that, you know, may not have the high upside of, you know, a lot of other pitchers, but on that team, you have to take notice. Let's jump to the next tier here. You know, it's part two of the low upside starting pitchers for watch lists. In reverse order here, six players: Manny Banuelos, Sean Nolan, Nate Karns, Kendall Graveman, Alex Colomay, and Mike Foltynewicz of the Braves. Now, Banuelos and Foltynewicz technically still competing for rotation spots, but it looks like Wandy Rodriguez, probably Eric Stoltz, get those nods.
That's exciting.
Super exciting. So in light of that, do you think that, you know, it's just a matter of time before they come in, or do you think Foltynewicz could even have some value in a relief role?
I think that Foltynewicz would be best suited now and long-term in a relief role. I mean, he walked a pitcher in today's game, which is, I mean, nice. In a spring training game, that kind of just tells you where he's at, yeah. Command wise right now. This is kind of a tier where you just kind of are throwing a dart, because I would be shocked almost if every single one of the guys in this tier didn't make at least one or two starts for their teams this year. The question is just, how productive are they going to be? How successful are they going to be? Because I would also, you know, I would wager that, you know, 2/3 of these guys probably finished the year with like an ERA above 4. Mm-hmm. So you want to make sure that, I mean, the key is to hit on the guy that does actually kind of emerge and become sort of this year's, you know, Jake DeGrom or whatever. Yeah. Obviously not going to be that good, but one of these guys probably does emerge and make himself mixed league relevant at some point.
Now, Alex Colomé, of course, dealing with, you know, battling back from an illness and not expected to be ready for the start of the season. But do you think it's, you know, you also have Nate Karns on this list. Do you think that Colomé is going to be able to, you know, return and maintain a spot in that rotation? Or, you know, does his spot being on this list and not in part in the first tier in this kind of category kind of suggest that, you know, kind of uncertain whether he will indeed stick?
Yeah, I just don't know right mm-hmm. now. Cobb and Smiley are both hurt. Matt Moore obviously out for a couple months. So, I mean, there's spots to go around right now. But Colomé has also got pneumonia, so yeah. He's not going to be ready to jump right into Smiley's spot. And by the time Smiley comes back, and, I mean, Colomé may be healthy, but there might not be a spot for him. So I think Nate Karns, the way things are looking right now, is the front runner to jump in there and occupy one of those spots. And then there's kind of not a lot to like other than Colomé, I guess, out of the potential rotation options there. So I mean, I think if there, but the nice thing is he'll be like the next option in line mm-hmm. Until Matt Moore's healthy. So you'll be looking at Archer, Odorizzi, Smiley, Karns, and Cobb, and then you'll have Colomé kind of as the guy just in waiting.
You know, I wouldn't really even recommend going after him in mixed leagues, but in NL or AL only. Last dollar you have. I do still like Birch Smith. I mean, call me stubborn. He was sent down to minor league camp, but it was also a report from the Tampa Bay Times that he's still in their early season plans. Seems like that, you know, reassignment was more so to, you know, get him more innings, get him prepared for the season. So I kind of like him. Now, Sean Nolan, another guy who got knocked around quite a bit yesterday, gave up a 3-run shot to Carlos Santana. Got, you know, struggled with his location. See, everything seemed really flat. Interesting that you have Graveman ahead of him. At least I think so. But I mean, Graveman's generated quite a bit of buzz. You just have so many starting options. You know, they stacked up with rotation depth, and hard to really know which is going to emerge. But I'm with you that Graveman is the guy to target there. Now, this last tier we're going to touch on today is definitely interesting. A lot of huge names. You know, mostly top 10 prospects on this list, with the exception of Jesse Winker. But the long shots to make an impact this year, starting in reverse order again, 5 players: Byron Buxton, Jesse Winker, Addison Russell, Joey Gallo, Miguel Sano. You know, Buxton is somebody who could still, you know, definitely make an impact, even if he's only up for, you know, a month and a half. But do you think that's even far from a given?
Buxton?
Yeah.
I would probably take the under on him being up in time to make much of an impact. I mean, I don't think he comes up until September at the earliest. And, you know, all it would take would be for him to struggle or for him to, like, you know, end up missing, you know, 2 weeks with an injury or something for him to not make it up at all. And, you know, the Twins aren't going to be in a spot where they're competing, really. So it's not like he would just be a valuable source of stolen bases or something like that. So mm-hmm. I don't see them bringing him up unless he just gets super hot, which is why he's in this tier. I mean, he's a long shot in the sense that he could just – I mean, if he does kind of a Mookie Betts this year and is just murdering all minor league pitching and really just forces the Twins' hand, they might be willing to give him a call because they're not drawing as well at that ballpark as I think they sort of expected to. And if Buxton was up and Sano was up, I mean, they would be probably top half of the league in attendance down the stretch. So, I mean, that definitely matters. And guys like – the thing about, like, guys like Buxton and Chris Bryant, it's not – like, these guys are going to get so paid. There's no – like, you're desperately hoping that you'll be able to sign them to an extension before they start getting to arbitration and everything like that. So, I mean, the service time and all those concerns, I mean, with guys like that, I mean, it's just – they're going to get super, super paid regardless.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a great point about, you know, attendance and, you know, Buxton, Sano, both, you know, that could spark so much interest there in Minneapolis. I could definitely see that. And Buxton, I think that the lost development time last year to the injuries, you know, does point to the likelihood that he does spend most of the year in the minors. But I'm with you that, you know, if they are, you know, hanging around and they can bring those two guys up, they're raking. I could definitely see that, and I'm excited to see Sano. I mean, he's had a couple home runs this spring. I know we talked about that gargantuan shot off Garrett Cole to dead center. Good to see him healthy, and you know that kind of power is through the roof. I had him as a top 10 prospect on my list. I think I had him even top 7, but I know in your initial rankings you had him outside the top 10. Where did you slot Sano in on your latest rankings? Do you remember?
I've been 7th.
Okay.
Nice. I think Derek had him 6th, I want to say. So, I mean, okay. He's going to be the composite ranks. He'll be 6th or 7th overall, I think.
Very nice. Now, Jesse Winker's a guy who was kind of blocked with the addition of Marlon Byrd. And, I mean, blocked, if you want to even call it that. But Winker, you know, impressive, you know, hit tool. Really good showing in the Arizona Fall League against other advanced prospects. But it's hard to know what this Reds team wants to do. I mean, they want to compete this year, but I also think, you know, that they're going to have to start taking the initial steps to a rebuild here shortly. So, you know, delaying Winker is something that they could do. I mean, but behind Byrd, who's, you know, 37 now, that could be Brennan Bosch. I mean, could be ugly. Do you think Winker... you know, is only an injury two away from starting, or do you think that realistically they're going to keep him down for as long as it can?
I don't think that he's quite as ready as maybe some people think. I think that he could prove himself ready in, like, say, July or something like that. I don't know. I mean, it wouldn't surprise me at all if he wasn't up this year. I mean, he hasn't... trying to look it up right now. I don't think he has that much experience at all at Double A. 21 games at Double A. So
yeah, he hurt his wrist soon after his promotion.
I mean, there's certainly a case to be made that he should be in the minors all league all season this year. And I don't really see him, even if they do need a replacement, even if there is an injury or something like that. I don't see him even getting a shot, regardless of how well he's doing, unless the Reds are contending. So, I mean, that's why he's a long shot. I mean, I'd bet against him being impactful at all this year.
You know, I'm probably with you on that. But I agree, he's a long shot. It could happen.
Yeah.
But, I think that is only if the Reds are competing, as they hope to do. But that was a tough one for me. As a Reds fan, doing my top 200, I almost wanted to push Winker ahead of Robert Stevenson, to be honest, just because I know, you know, you have some concerns about Stevenson's long-term role, and Stevenson had that shoulder trouble before, and I just think Winker's floor is higher, but I ended up slotting Stevenson in just 2 spots ahead of Winker. Do you remember how close you had those guys?
No, not off the top of my head. I know Derek had Winker like just outside his top 20, so was the high man on him. I think he'll end up slotting in like around the 35 range.
Yeah, I had him at 38, so I think that's probably fair. Now, that'll do it for the actual baseball prospect talk on the show. Thank you for listening. We are going to grade out a classic WWF tag team here on the 20-80 scale based on the 5 tools for professional wrestlers that we have come up with through numerous discussions. Yes, we do discuss this quite a bit, but the five tools, in case you haven't heard this segment of the show before: look, entrance, signature move, command of the crowd, and ring presence. Yeah, I think that's definitely the five things that matter most for a professional wrestler.
Yeah, I mean, basically the reason we picked the natural disasters was because we just kind of went with, you know, Mr. Perfect, Ultimate Warrior were the first two we did. I mean, those might be our two favorite wrestlers in overall. I mean, so kind of just cherry picking studs, and it we thought it'd be kind of funny to, you know, break down some guys who really really don't grade out that well at all.
Yeah, I mean, handing out 80s nonstop is fun and all.
I mean, it gets boring, you know.
Yeah, exactly. We want to switch it up and, you know, kind of hit the bottom of the barrel, actually. Just, I mean, I can't even say that. I mean, there have been a lot worse. And individually, these guys were probably worse, even though Earthquake did, you know, feud with Hulk Hogan there for a while. You know, I think for the championship, too. So, you know, he had more success on his own. But as a tag team, this was kind of a middling combo here. But the natural disasters, I do love that name, Typhoon and Earthquake. I actually used it for a fantasy team name once, but that was not a good call because my team actually was a complete disaster. But let's start with Tugboat. James, what do you got for the look here?
You know, I gave him a 25 on the 20 to 80 scale. Two things I felt separated Tugboat from Earthquake in a positive manner in the look department. One, he had a full head of hair. It might have been plugs, but it was less off-putting than Earthquake's kind of, you know, sweaty, bald,
so
long
sweaty
hair.
Yeah, you know, bald, just, but with the long hair.
Wet and red. And you know, the other thing that goes in Tugboat's favor here with the look is that sometimes he wore long pants. You know, his Tugboat costume sometimes kept his entire lower body covered up, which I thought kind of added to the watchability of a Tugboat fight.
Yes, that is something I didn't really take into account, but you're right. I mean, thank you, Tugboat, for wearing pants. Because
thanks for covering up.
I mean, that singlet that Earthquake wore was disgusting. I mean, those thighs just thumping out. But I actually gave Earthquake the slight edge in look, only because he was actually like kind of menacing and you didn't want anything to do with him. So as a wrestler, I think that is kind of important. I had Tugboat as a 20 look.
Yeah,
I mean, far cry from the Ultimate Warrior.
If you're just if what you're looking for is look and look is intimidation, then I'll give Earthquake the nod there.
I mean, it's a part of it, I'd say.
Yeah, for me, it's not about intimidation. It's about just looking awesome.
That's true, but when you're one of these guys and, you know, you're beefy to say the least, I think the intimidation factor. Tugboat just looked, you know, Typhoon / Tugboat just look too nice most of the time. But I will say Fred Ottman, the guy who went by those names, played those characters, looking a lot better now. I mean, for a professional wrestler,
rare,
his Wikipedia.
Rare
picture
to look better as a professional wrestler like 30 years after you
at age 58, looking a heck of a lot better than he did 20 years.
Mostly
ago.
Because he was fully covered up and not sweating in that picture.
Sweating. And, yeah, had a button-up shirt completely covered. We'll go to, okay, so, again, 20 look for me for Tugboat, 25 for you. Earthquake, 25 look for me, 20 look for you.
So this is compelling stuff.
This is real compelling. Now, entrance, what do you got for Tugboat?
25. I mean, you know, he seemed really happy to be there, you know, you know, kind of interacting with the crowd in kind of a happy way, you know, like, you know, just kind of happy that people came to watch him in the ring, you know, but nothing intimidating, nothing, nothing that memorable.
Yeah, exactly. Nothing memorable. I had him 25-2. I could even
doing
see the argument.
Doing the tugboat horn.
Yeah, that was like his whole music, too. It's just a horn playing. So, I mean, not, again, I mean, we're kind of lumping these two characters of his together. But I think that's fair because the typhoon entrance was not that memorable. We'll go to signature move, and this is an easy 20 for me. Just a big splash for tugboat. What made you go up to 25? No real reason. That's fine too.
No, I don't know. I can't really defend it not being a 20.
Just zero athleticism.
Guys, watching
required.
These guys, like the squish profile. I think like just a lot of their moves were just kind of about you know, just kind of
laying on top,
just laying on guys.
Yeah,
not really trying to do much damage. Mostly just kind of, you know, using their body and, you know, treating the ropes kind of like you would treat like a nice like beanbag chair. Just kind of like lazily flopping into them and like kind of even sitting in them at times.
Yeah, and then
like
just like jumping one inch off the ground.
Like using the ropes kind of as a chair because they were tired. A lot of slack really in the overall routine.
Yeah, elite slack profiles for both of these guys. Now, getting back to entrance though, I gave Earthquake a 30 just because I liked his kind of liked his music. It was another kind of bland one, but it was just kind of, I mean, he felt the tremors kind of, which was fitting for a guy named Earthquake. But for Earthquake's signature move though, I gave that a 45. I mean, as you just described, it was just elite squish, but the pre-move jump around the ring.
Yeah, that was
great.
I mean, it's comical. it's not an impactful or, mm-hmm. I mean, it's kind of, you know, akin to like a toddler kind of that doesn't have what they want, and you know they're in line at a grocery store or something. They want some candy. Just jumping around and trying to make an earthquake like effect in the ring. Didn't do a lot for me.
No, I hear you. I guess I just have fond memories as a kid playing WWF WrestleFest too in the arcades.
I could see that being fun to reenact in a video game.
Yeah, and I mean, I do remember him doing it to Hogan a couple times, and you know, really putting Hogan out of commish. So I kind of always had a soft spot for that move. But I'm with you. Not a lot of you know, athletic ability or talent, you know, needed to perform that move. Now, command a crowd for tugboat. All these grades are really pretty similar, but you had a 30 for command a crowd. Any specific reason?
Not really. I mean, the crowd seemed to kind of be on his side, which, mm-hmm. you know, it's got to count for something. But no, I couldn't really explain that very well.
Yeah, I'll just say that
I felt I wanted to give him 130, so yeah. that was the one I chose to give him.
No, I'm with you. I mean, nothing special about the guy. I mean, when he was in the ring, the crowd was kind of apathetic. And plus, I had to downgrade him, too, because he just couldn't talk on the mic. I mean, he needed a mouthpiece, the mouth of the South, Jimmy Hart. And he was also, when he went to WCW, one of the biggest blunders in wrestling history. He took on a character called the Shockmaster. And the Shockmaster wore a glittered Stormtrooper's mask.
Okay.
And he actually, they had like a dubbed voiceover, so he didn't even have to talk. So that's really a reason to downgrade him there. Now for Earthquake, I had a 25 command a crowd. You had 20. This is another one where I think it's just yeah, he needed a mouthpiece too. I guess when he was in the ring, maybe I should have bumped him up to 30. Just because, you know, when this guy, I mean, he's a massive guy, when he's in the crowd, he does command some attention.
But, yeah. I noticed the crowd wasn't off and on his side. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I can't really explain. I can't really explain that great either.
Ring presence. Yeah. We don't need to explain these. I mean,
ring
scouts
presence,
don't need to.
I just wanna say for Earthquake's ring presence, his like hype man guy that would have the speakerphone,
Jimmy Hart,
and just jump around with his hands in the air, like when Earthquake was about to pull off a feat. I found that guy kind of comical.
Yeah, he helped he helped. And I had 35 ring presents for Earthquake, 30 for Typhoon. Now as a tag team, integrating these guys individually, yeah, I think we'd both settle on the 30 range. But as a tag team, would you give them a higher overall scouting grade? Just given the name.
Yeah, no, I think I could go up to like a 40. You know, still bringing a ton of slack, but, you know, combining forces and just mm-hmm. doing, you know, the double arm bars. You know, they're just really kind of lovable little high fives after they knock a guy down. I mean, to kind of a lovable yeah. duo.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely greater force as a team than individually. But again, I did mention Earthquake did have some singles success, but I think as a team they just worked. And you know, maybe we'll have to touch on some more tag teams. I saw, I think it was Bleacher Report was doing a, you know, NCAA type of bracket with the 64 best tag teams of all time. I thought that was a pretty nice. Good idea. But don't know who we're going to do next week yet, but maybe we can settle on that and announce it on Twitter. But thank you for listening to the RotoWire Prospect Podcast. We will have a separate RSS feed for this podcast built, but again, it is just currently in the RotoWire Fantasy Baseball Podcast feed. Thanks again for James Anderson on Twitter at RealJRAnderson. I'm Clay Link at ClayWLink. We'll see you next week.